You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
You're listening to STEMcast, brought to you by McGill iGEM.
Today, STEMcast listeners, we have Dr. Jane Adu from Portland State University, who was actually the original starter for McGill iGEM almost as many years ago as I am old. But it's wonderful to have her with us today, and I'm really excited to ask her a couple questions about iGEM and about her research as well. So, starting off, you've had a career in education and academia that has kind of taken you across the East and the West of the US and Canada. Can you explain a little bit about what decisions you made that took you to work at first McGill and then Caltech and now PSU?
Yeah, so it was really a tough decision that I had in 2004. I had a few great offers. I was at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, and I wanted to make the move into academia to be able to teach and work with students. And I had a bunch of offers, and it was just such a hard decision. You know, one of them was from UC Davis. One of them was from University of Maine / Bar Harbor. And the other one was from McGill. And so what finally tipped the balance was the fact that McGill was fairly close, actually, to the Jackson Lab in Bar Harbor, Maine. So I could maintain contact with the people in Bar Harbor while working at McGill. And so that was exciting. And it was also just, I just loved, you know, the culture and the richness of Montreal. And it was different from everything I knew. And I thought, I really want to go to Montreal.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's kind of my choice to go to Montreal as well. And then looking a little bit back, you worked at McGill for a solid amount of time before moving, I believe.
Yeah,
wonderful. Before moving to Caltech and then PSU, is that correct?
That's correct.
And what was your choice to move away from Montreal after spending 11 years at McGill?
Well, there was a couple of reasons. I mean, there was a personal reason in that I had to take care of my aging parents and they couldn't come into Canada. So that was kind of driving a lot of it. And that makes it hard when you cross borders and you don't really think about that. So there's that. And then there was sort of a NASA reason. I was hoping to be able to really plug into some NASA missions. We were hoping NASA was going to go to Europa, is the short answer. They decided not to go to Europa, so that was fairly disappointing. But I was hoping to get an opportunity to work on a mission where we would send an instrument, or at least propose an instrument, to go to Europa.
That's wonderful. And then this one is a little personal to me because I grew up in Oregon, actually, an hour outside of PSU. It was a little bit crazy to me to just see that you had ended up at PSU.
Yeah.
What made you choose our wonderful green state?
So I interviewed at PSU actually a couple of years before I took the position here. There was a joint OHSU-PSU position, which I didn't get. So then I just took this visiting position at Caltech that was soft money, you know, hoping that PSU's positions would open up again. And they thought that they would. So I was just kind of waiting for them to come up with an offer. And they eventually did. And I said, this is great, because I was really excited about coming to Oregon and working both here and at OHSU. There's a couple people I actually went to graduate school with who are faculty at OHSU. And it was
awesome.
Yeah, just a neat combination of factors, plus the fact that I love the Cascade Volcanoes so much.
Yeah, there's a lot of really cool things to be happy about in Oregon, I would say. And then speaking a little bit about your time at McGill, and this is why I had chosen to reach out to you in the first place, it's my understanding that you were an integral part of creating the original first McGill iGEM team back in 2007. What led you to creating this team, and what was your motivation for creating a team in synthetic biology? Because I know that was, at the time, a very kind of jumping off point field to see.
So really all the credit for this has to go to the students. I had this absolutely superb group of students. I was teaching a class that had, you know, a molecular biology class that had a lab component. And there were some students from that class, as well as some students from outside that class, who said, have you heard about iGEM? Let's do it. And so some of these students are now, you know, one of them I know is an oncologist living in Ontario. And yeah, just really, really motivated, driven students who came and said, we just love the idea of this iGEM team. We need to do this. And they really came up with the idea and really helped drive it. We had several different projects with different people who are working on different aspects of it, because there are just more ideas than you could pare down to just a single thing. So yeah, really all credit goes to the students who found it and said, we think we can do this. And at the time, iGEM was small enough that this was really reasonable. We could just say, hey, yeah, let's make an iGEM team. And that was kind of all we needed to do. I know it's a lot harder now.
Yeah, I mean, it is, it's gotten bigger for sure, but it's still interesting to see that, like, at the base of it, it's just passionate people, which is, I mean, it's the experience and what I've seen from iGEM in my years as well. So it's good to see that that was there from the beginning. Have you heard much about the recent McGill iGEM team's projects and what we've done over
I haven't heard anything. Can you tell me something?
I would love to elucidate a little bit. So this version, I guess, of McGill iGEM has been active since 2022. And since then, we've had like three major products that we've actually been able to take to competition, which has been awesome. The first version of the team, which until probably 6 months ago, it was what I thought was the first version of the team ever, did a probiotic for the digestion of cholesterol called Cobiota, which was a pretty interesting project and was our big kind of kickoff point. We got 10th, or we were top 10 that year, which was a great accomplishment for a first-year team. And then after that, we came back in 2023 with a project called Proteus, which was a fusion protein-based CRASP-based module for the detection and deletion of pancreatic cancer, which was a pretty pressing one and a big issue. And that was probably what brought most of the funding back to the program, I would say. And working in cancer, we were able to actually win iGEM in 2023, which was, I mean, I wish I was there, but it seemed like a very, very fun thing to do. Yeah, as I've joined the team last year, we've done a little bit of work in DNA computing and diagnostics to create a sepsis diagnostic tool called Nucleo, which we got a couple of nominations for at competition. And then this year, we still have to see. We'll see. What I was going to ask is kind of a follow-up to that question, I guess, would be beyond like the passion of the students and the organization of the program, is there something that you could give as a piece of advice to iGEM teams on how to keep a team going successfully, whether that is about like fostering that passion or, I guess, keeping things rolling?
Yeah, I think the real key is to have something that's actually achievable. So it's really easy to have a whole lot of great ideas and then not make any substantial progress towards them in the possible time. And certainly there, especially in the first few years of iGEM, there were a lot of people who kind of gave up doing any of the experiments at all pretty early on when the BioBricks didn't work or they ran into cloning problems, and then just end up with a purely theoretical project. And while those could be kind of neat, it was fundamentally disappointing if none of your experiments actually worked. So I think having a handle on, you know, what you can actually accomplish, and then also on the timelines, like literally down to knowing what the doubling time is of whatever cells you're working on. So whether you're working with E. coli, B. subtilis, or cells in a dish, you know, plan out your time over that summer for how many generations you're going to be able to have. And so how many different things you're going to be able to test, and know exactly what you're going to be able to accomplish so you can get the data that you need to get, because it can be very frustrating if you just find yourself 90% of the way through the summer and you haven't got anything. So, you know, start with something you can really handle. And I think the other thing is try not to get too bogged down with cloning, because cloning can really just take forever. So if you can get the cloning done even before the summer starts, you got a big jump on it.
Yeah, I know we took probably 2 months of our summer to do cloning last year, and it does bog you down. It's troubling. Well, that's wonderful advice. Thank you so much. This one's a little bit more specific because I have a couple of friends who are in bioengineering and passionate about synthetic biology, but also trying to make the choice between physics and bioengineering as an undergraduate degree and trying to identify what they'd be most passionate about. And I wanted to ask, with your degree as a physicist, that gives you a strong basis for biology and bioengineering as a whole, but also given that you are passionate in biology and bioengineering beyond physics and into space and more, how would you recommend someone pursue an education in this like interdisciplinary field of physics and biology if they want to end up in a position like you?
So I think you almost can never go wrong with an undergraduate degree in physics because it is very flexible and allows you to do a whole lot of things. But then it is nice to get a jump in grad school with having some sort of hands-on bio experience so that if you walk into a bio lab, you're not completely lost. That is something, though, that you can get at the grad level. So if you do your undergrad degree in physics, there are a lot of graduate training programs that come with an element of getting people up to speed. So even the McGill bioengineering program or biomedical engineering program when I was there would take people with pure physics or physical sciences degrees and allow them to catch up in a year of taking biology courses. So there are a lot of grad programs that do let you catch up in the terms of biology. So I think, again, you can't go wrong with a physics degree ever. But if you know a biomedical engineering or bioengineering program that really fits kind of exactly what you like, or has specific courses or specific research programs that really fit with something that you just love, then that's also a good option. But you definitely don't need to major in bioengineering or biomedical engineering to get a PhD in it. You can get a PhD in physics, chemistry, biology, whatever.
I guess to that extent, if you were in, I guess, our shoes today, knowing that you wanted to end up in bioengineering, do you think you would take the same route of going undergraduate in physics, mastering that, and then pursuing in other directions?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful to hear. Before we move on to a little bit of talking about your research, I wanted to get a little bit of your opinions and hear a little bit about the earliest iGEM team. Out of the projects that you were able to do during that period of time, is there one that really spoke to you and that you were really passionate to be a part of?
Yeah, so we actually got E. coli to flicker and express GFP in a periodic fashion. So that was actually really exciting. And we spent literally all night, three times at the confocal microscope, watching these E. coli blink on off and on.
Oh, that's wonderful.
We ended up writing a paper for PhysRevE on the theory behind it, which was also neat. And what was so cool about this is that if you do the simple crude model of the gene expression in those cells, they really shouldn't have been oscillatory. But if you included a time delay in the differential equations, then it did become oscillatory. So it let us know that the typical equations for gene expression and translation and transcription need to include this time delay for the time it takes to do the transcription and do the translation. And then you end up with these beautiful oscillations. And so that really kind of led me into the whole entire field of time delay differential equations, which turns out is just a field unto itself. So that project was amazing because, first of all, the cells blinked off and on, which was really cool. But second of all, it really opened my eyes to this entire field of research that is often neglected, especially when you're talking about, you know, things like the repressilator and the differential equations for it. Usually the time delay is kind of neglected, but it turns out it's really important and really cool. And that with these time delay systems, you can actually get chaotic behavior with just a couple of parameters and very, very simple systems. You can end up with chaos if you have time delay differential equations. So it's just really neat to learn that.
That's wonderful. I actually was hoping you would go that direction. Because in our like intro to biomolecular engineering class, which is a kind of intro class that we take in bioengineering, we talk about repressilators and we talk a little bit about the E. coli cycling of GFP. I don't know if we actually specifically cite your paper, but it is pretty cool to learn that like that is our synthetic biology unit. And it's wonderful to learn, wonderful to see.
What I'm actually trying to get somebody interested in now is, and spread the word if you think anybody might be interested in this, is the idea that you might be able to get PT symmetry systems in biology. So basically, parity time symmetric Hamiltonians that you could get with a repressilator-like system that essentially just means that you have to have one element that's like a positive resistance and one that's like a negative one. So coupled circuits where one element is positive and one is negative will give you a PT symmetric behavior. And it's people have been able to create these systems in electronics, but nobody's done it in biology yet. And even just modeling
Interesting.
would be super cool. So yeah, spread the word if anybody is interested. I keep trying to get someone here really interested in it, but they're not biologists at all, so they kind of got lost in it. But it's something I think is really cool.
That does sound really cool. So these PT systems would be kind of a way to model more advanced equations in biology beyond something like a repressilator that has both negative and positive feedback, or
Yes.
okay,
Yes, you
interesting.
have to have some sort of a coupled, poly coupled repressilators, one positive, one negative.
Interesting to see. I'll definitely push that out to listeners and system on the iGEM team as well. To speak more a little bit about your degree and your past in academia. What led you to take your degree specifically into more astrophysics and microbiology? And in this really cool intersection of what I think is probably one of the coolest fields of physics and microbial life that we're a little bit more attuned and that we know more about here on iGEM in this podcast.
Yeah, so I was doing a postdoc at Caltech, and somebody named Ken Nielsen had just been hired by the Jet Propulsion Lab to do astrobiology. And this was right at the turn of the century. So it was all very exciting, Y2K stuff. Ken had come from the University of Wisconsin, where he had an endowed chair in microbiology, and JPL was hiring him to basically look for life on Mars. So Ken came down to Caltech and gave this incredible talk, just entranced all of us, where he said, we're going to go to Mars and we're going to look for bacterial life. And essentially, nobody had gone and looked for life on Mars since Viking in 1976. So the Viking mission was this multi-billion dollar flagship mission that looked for life on Mars, and it came up with totally inconclusive results. So we were very excited that maybe we would get to look finally specifically for life again. And the idea was that by 2009, there would be sample return. Well, that hasn't happened, unfortunately. But there was a lot of excitement and a lot of research around it where people said, well, if there was life on Mars, what would it look like? And we obviously knew a whole lot more about microbial life on Earth than we did in 1976. And so what people were saying is, in 1976, we didn't even know that there was microbial life in the Atacama Desert. We barely knew that there was microbial life in the ocean, largely because these things are not that culturable. If you take a sample out and you spread it in a petri dish, nothing grows. But the life is there. So, how do you detect it? And so, you can ask, how do you find life on Mars? By asking, how do you find life in the Atacama Desert? How do you find life in the glowing foot in Chernobyl? All of these really extreme areas on Earth where there's absolutely nothing besides bacteria, but there's always bacteria. So, how do you find them? What do they do? What do they eat? What do they breathe? How do you prove that they're alive? When did they evolve? All of these questions, even if you never get to another planet, are just incredible questions to ask on Earth.
I guess to that extent of like classifying and figuring out how to find these bacteria, whether it might be in the pits of the oceans or the sand of the desert, is in your experience, because I know some of your work is in microscopy and specific imaging, is it all about taking different types of microscopy and adapting to the situation that you have to use when it comes to identification of these bacteria?
So I actually am almost alone in saying we need to use a microscope. NASA has been traditionally opposed to microscopy for a lot of reasons. It's kind of odd, but there you go. The Japanese Space Agency is actually developing microscopes, which is very cool. There's a lot of microscopy in Japan and a lot of, big microscope companies such as Olympus. So the Japanese Space Agency has developed a fluorescence microscope for searching for life on Mars, but NASA has been opposed. Like, look, hands down, we will not support microscopy. Yeah. And so, a lot of what NASA scientists have been doing to look for life doesn't involve imaging at all. It involves basically grinding up a sample and using mass spectrometry, GC, various other biochemical techniques to try to understand what the chemical composition is.
Do you have an inkling as to why NASA has been against fluorescence microscopy in the past and now the present, and when it comes to identification?
There was a head of the NASA Astrobiology Agency who just kept saying, you'll never see anything. And there's also just a tradition of most NASA scientists have been Earth scientists. And so what, and NASA was also kind of embarrassed by Viking not being conclusive. And so the whole idea is, well, you don't want to lose your ability to get funding by having an inconclusive experiment or a negative result. And so if we're going to send this expensive mission, it has to bring back all of the Earth science. And so we know if we go to Mars and look for a rock, we're going to find a rock. Never be disappointed there. So if we send instruments that will really, really well characterize the minerals, then we can't really fail.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all of the missions have been, we're not looking for life. We're just looking for characterization. And from that, maybe we can infer habitability. But it's kind of pre-selecting for, you know, just for geology instruments. And then they say, well, if we send this package of geology instruments, because we certainly can't fail looking for a rock, you know, could we find life? Could we find signs of life? And it, then the whole thought turned to, well, you could see habitability. You could see signs of past water. And so everyone's been interested in looking for signs that minerals have evolved in the presence of water and that sort of thing, which is not really the same as looking for life, but it's a lot lower risk. Because, yeah, so, if you send a microscope and you don't see anything, you know, then you just kind of don't see anything.
So it's kind of this idea of, for a while now, NASA's been building the bottom-up approach to detection of life, where they're looking at background and habitability, then actually the top-down of like, oh, we can physically see a microbe or bacteria.
That's right. Yeah. And Chris McKay, who's an astrobiologist at NASA, actually put it as, we're looking for life, but we want to look for life, but not for something alive. So they want to see chemistry, but not necessarily looking for something alive.
Does this approach, you think, I guess the better way to phrase this question would be, do you think that this approach could more helpfully identify past historical signs of life than something like microscopy? Or
yes, and I think that's another issue too, is that on Mars it's very likely that any life that was there died out, and so because everyone was so laser focused on Mars and not on places where that might have existing life, you always have to say, well, what if it's extinct, right? How do you find extinct microorganisms? And that's really challenging even on Earth. So yeah, if you're looking for extinct microorganisms, microscopy is not the best way. And how are you going to do it? And it's a big question, and it's tough.
Speaking as to in what you had just mentioned on like focusing a little bit too much on Mars, and what you had mentioned earlier about projects that had possibly been looking in other places that had been canceled before, is there a direction that space agencies are going for identification of life outside of Mars in other places? Or is that something that's...
There are a few target areas, and the Decadal Survey comes out once every 10 years and, you know, suggests a direction for NASA research. And in the last Decadal Survey, the second highest priority was a mission to Enceladus to look for life. And so Enceladus is the moon of Saturn that has liquid water plumes shooting out of it. These water plumes contain every organic ingredient or every inorganic ingredient that we know is necessary for life. So all of the salts, phosphorus, and so on are known to be present, as well as a global ocean. So, and what's nice about Enceladus is its escape velocity is very low. It's 200 meters per second or so. So you could technically land and send something up, or you could orbit very close to the planet and collect from the plumes as they shoot without even having to land. That makes your mission a whole lot cheaper. So this is a lot easier in some sense than going to Europa, where the ice crust is a kilometer thick. And so actually getting into the ocean is a huge, huge task. Another thing I'm excited about is the Clouds of Venus. because actually somewhere within the clouds of Venus is the only other place in the solar system that has Earth standard STP, so standard temperature and pressure, somewhere in the clouds. Wow. Don't go all the way down, but you know, somewhere in there you've got STP. So there could be microbial life living in the clouds of Venus. It's also a whole lot closer than Saturn. So we could get there in a few months. And sampling the clouds of Venus, again, does not require you to land. So you don't have this whole gravity well problem for sending samples back. So I'm excited about that as well.
Not to ask you to like pick between your favorite children here, but do you think out of those three possibilities and capabilities, which one do you think personally is the most possible to contain signs of life or possible life? And secondly, which one do you think space agencies will probably investigate first, whether that be in the future or down the line?
I can't second guess the space agencies because they sort of change their minds all the time, and it all depends on competed missions in yeah. general. So sometimes there's a single flagship that's chosen and funded, but most of the time you have cheaper missions that are competed. And so that just really depends on who puts together proposals. So that's really hard to second guess. But in terms of my favorite, I'm going to say Venus, both because I really prefer things to be warmer. Just from a personal point of view, if I were a microbe, you wouldn't catch me living at 20 Kelvin or whatever it is. And from a personal point of view, you can get there in a few months because it'll take 3 to 7 years to fly to Saturn. And nobody wants to just sit around and wait for 7 years to get any data back.
My other question is something that I've written down at the beginning of this, which was kind of the aliens yes or no question. It kind of comes to the point of two things, I guess. Do you think that microbial life exists in the present day? And maybe that's Venus at STP, maybe that's somewhere else. Or is it something that is more likely to have had existed in the past and gone through some sort of Fermi paradox kind of death event that has caused some sort of extinction as well?
So I'm completely 100% agnostic on these questions because we only have one data point. And so that's the big, huge question in my mind. And that's why I find this field so fascinating, is that from a thermodynamic point of view, you know, I think this all comes down to thermo and stat mech, right? In the end, and what is the chance of life evolving? And our estimates for the probability of life evolving on a planet range anywhere from, you know, 1 in 10 to the 12 to probability equals 1. Because we just have no idea. We just have no idea. So yeah, is it absolutely inevitable that life evolves, or is it extraordinarily rare? And I think we need to go to a few places and find out in order to know the answer to that question, because with only one data point, you can't even draw a straight line.
Yeah, it's a really succinct way to put it. And I like that. Do you think the direction that the space agencies have been going with identification of life, I know a lot of it has been more bottom up, I guess. Do you think that direction will bring us the results, maybe a second data point in the next century? Or is that something that is kind of going to be very dependent on if they change directions in the future?
Yeah, I think it's just as stochastic as the evolution of life itself. It kind of depends a lot on politics. You know, every time there's a new administration in the US, NASA changes its directions substantially. And then you have other countries that may play a role, larger or smaller. You know, what is China going to do? And what is Japan going to do? I think it's sort of like, you know, those RNA expression levels from your BioBricks. They can fluctuate to zero. And if they fluctuate to zero, you get nothing. But if you have just one hit and just one molecule that does what it's supposed to do. So that's, yeah, if we have one successful life detection mission, that may be the one. But is it going to happen? It's kind of up in the air. And part of the issue, too, is that we haven't really looked on Mars because there are these so-called Mars special regions that are areas that are more likely to contain life. They contain water, ice, and so on. But there's international agreements to not pollute those regions. So very, very strict requirements on how you have to sterilize spacecraft before they go there. And something that international community has all agreed on. So no one has gone to the special regions, but they're the regions most likely to contain life. So there's still a lot to be done on Mars that we haven't done. And, you know, who's going to do it? Who's going to come up with the budget necessary to visit one of these regions and actually look?
Yeah. I mean, just because that piqued my interest a little bit, hearing about the special Mars regions, do you think microscopy characterization techniques would be a more efficient way to characterize something in these regions without polluting as much or without as much direct interference in these areas?
Yeah, I think we definitely need microscopy, and I think the JAXA instrument that they've developed for looking for, you know, fluorescently labeling and imaging bacteria on Mars is the perfect instrument for that. So I think the Japanese really have the idea for this. I would love to see their instrument go there.
And then to a point in what you guys have been working on in your lab in PSU, do you think you're hoping to put forward research that will be able to kind of help this process along the way in the detection of life? Or is that more of a
So we've been more focused on water worlds. So we were more sort of thinking Europa or Enceladus. So if we have an opportunity to contribute to a water world mission, then we're right on board with that. So Mars is a rocky world. It's a different sort of thing, different sort of instrument. We haven't been focused on developing a rocky world microscope, but if there were a mission to go and do fluorescence microscopy in a rocky world, I would love to contribute to it in any way possible. Whether that be NASA, ESA, JAXA, whoever it is, it would be wonderful to be involved in some way because I think it should be done. I think that what we are building though is for water.
And then to that extent of working in a water world, are there additional considerations? I'm sure there are, that you have to make for working with water-based samples and detection of life in water rather than on land?
Yeah, it is really different because with water, you can flow the sample through, you can concentrate it with a filter. You don't have to worry so much about background fluorescence from minerals and things. And so you're just treating the sample very differently. And then also you're quite likely to be able to see things swimming if there's anything that's living in the water. So imaging on rocks. The rocks are going to be fluorescent, which can be beautiful in and of itself and also very useful. But the bacteria are also fluorescent. You can dye them to make them more fluorescent over the background of the rock. But then you also need to image in reflection, so you can't image in transmission, you can't look through it. So it's just sort of, it's different optics, different approaches to labeling the cells, and then kind of different things that you're looking for. Because if you have a cell that's sitting on a rock and it's not moving, how are you going to be sure it's a cell and not just, you know, a piece of sulfur or something like that? And even on Earth, that can be, it can be ambiguous. So then say you see something that really looks like a cell, how are you going to prove it? Then you want really want to get into the biochemistry. So you want to be able to pick that cell up, transfer it over to your next instrument and figure out what it is this thing that you found is made of. And that's going to be different, whether it's on a rock or in some liquid. So it's definitely a different approach for, you know, minerals and water.
And then as far as a water world exploration, something like that, how far in the future do you see something like this happening? I know that's a very subjective
Yeah.
question to ask, of course, but
You know, we all dream about 2030, but yeah, in 2000 they said there would be Mars sample return in 2009, and in 2009 they said it would be in 2018, and in 2018 they said it would be, you know, it's always 9 years away.
yeah, makes sense.
So
Are there space agencies that you would kind of think of as like being on the forefronts of going towards something like a water world exploration, or is everyone still a bit focused on Mars?
who is going to go? Yeah, that's a really good question. Who's going to go to a water world first? I really don't know. And, you know, I don't want to get into current events in the United States because that would go down a deep
Different.
pit.
Yeah.
But it could be that the US will lose all global influence and then it will come down to ESA or JAXA or somebody to, or China to really lead the next generation of exploration. But so far, really, only NASA has managed to successfully land on Mars and deploy a series of instruments. ESA's had a couple of great missions that One of them had a microscope on it, but it crashed. So probably these other agencies, when they start out, would probably start out by exploring Mars, although you never really know. So, and yeah. Russia, you know, went to Venus decades before anybody else even thought of these things successfully. But you can't really rely on Russia so much anymore either. So the superpowers have disintegrated. And so now who are we looking to for the future of exploration?
We'll have to see, huh?
Yeah.
All right. I think this is probably my last little question for us today then. Could you give us a little bit, and this might speak a little bit to what we've talked about already with Waterworld exploration, but could you give us a little insight or sneak peek at some research that your lab is currently working on? Kind of a STEMcast exclusive, obviously not revealing too much, but.
So actually today, as we speak, we are packaging up our flight hardware to go to the International Space Station. So all we have to do right now is print out the labels and take it to the post office. And it's got to be at Johnson Space Center by next Friday. And so that's the early load stuff. So we're sending a microscope, a holographic microscope, custom made for the space station, and a bunch of syringes and sample chambers and things for the astronauts to manipulate. But the actual flight is not going to occur till April. So a week before the actual flight, we're going to send them a bag full of bacteria. But, you know, since they're alive, they're so-called late load, so we're not going to put them on till the last second. But everything else has got to go in today.
That's incredibly cool. That will be very interesting to see. I hope we see and hear about that on the next ISS mission.
It's nerve-wracking. I just hope our laser survives the launch.
I hope so too. Well, it was wonderful to get a chance to talk to you today about the research and about IGEM. It seems like from the beginning, IGEM has been about passion at McGill, and I'm glad to hear a little bit about your ideas behind starting it and where that's led you now.
Yeah,
thank you so much for joining me.
You're still doing it. And, you know, again, if anybody's interested in PT symmetry, look me up and we can talk about that, because
I'll
it's
send
something
your way.
Sort of put on the back burner, but I love the idea.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Have a nice day. Thank you so much for joining me.
Ciao.